All right, good morning, everyone. We're getting started here. First of all, thank you to, again, another thank you to Ron and Peggy Loudon for sponsoring this morning's class, having covered the entire slate of November classes. It's been a pleasure, and we thank you for your sponsorship. We have the next couple of classes also already squared away. But if anybody would like to sponsor any further upcoming classes, we're going to be doing this fairly regularly, just about every Sunday. So there will be more classes and more opportunities for sponsorship. If you would like to sponsor a class, please speak to me or Elsa, Sandy, somebody in the office, and we'll make sure that we get you down. Okay, this morning's topic, Birkat HaGomel, the Thanksgiving blessing. Very appropriate. Very appropriate for this week. We got Thanksgiving on the mind, so we are going to take a look at what we consider to be Thanksgiving. And when we give thanks, we do so often in a more formalized prayer kind of context or blessing sort of context. We know that Modim is a section that we recite at each one of the Shmona Esrays that we recite throughout the day. So we, at a bare minimum, we are going to be engaged on a daily basis in an act of thanksgiving, three times a day. That's at a bare minimum. Then there is this other idea, this Birkas HaGomel, okay, which you may never have had to recite in your entire life. More often than not, you have some sort of opportunity to recite this blessing. And try to push out of your mind, at least for now, whatever reason you may have recited this blessing for. Because what we're really going to take a look at today is exactly when do we recite this blessing. So try to clear your mind of, not of everything you know, but at least of whatever you know about the Birkat HaGomel, so we can start with a fresh slate. If we were, and again, as many of our classes allow for, we're going to take a look at the actual development of the Halakha, which means that we're going to begin with the Talmud, right, which is the first place where this is actually going to be recorded and formalized, really, and then see how it's interpreted, how it's understood by the various commentators throughout the generations until we come down to more practical law today, which is really the best way to ever understand any halacha, right? To start from the beginning and then to kind of work our way through the generations, see how it's interpreted over time. Specifically, what we're going to focus on, what we'll end up with, is that there is really a distinction in terms of how this blessing is understood and then put into practice in the Ashkenazic and Sephardic communities. Okay, so this is not just an exercise in practical halakha, this is also something of an exercise or example in socio-halachic distinctions between those two communities, between the Ashkenazic community and Sephardic community. Okay, which should be very interesting. Let's begin with the Gemara. Okay, Talmud and Brachos. This is actually interesting because what we're delving into now is a Gemara that is sort of off the beaten path. We discussed some Gemaras surrounding this last week when we dealt with all of those Gemaras dealing with dream interpretation. So we go back to that same section of the Gemara and Brachos, but this time for much more of a formal halachic kind of interpretation and perspective. Here we go. Bottom of page one. Rabbi Yehuda said in the name of Rav, four individuals must thank God. Now, what we're speaking about specifically is an additional bracha. This doesn't mean, it's not referring to the modim, the thanksgiving section of the Shmona Esrei. We're saying that there are four people, or there are four scenarios in which a person might find himself, or herself, that upon exiting from that situation, that person is now obligated to thank God in a different sort of context, in a different way, not just the regular Shmona Esrei type of thanksgiving, but a specific blessing because of having been through that experience and having been through that circumstance. So four individuals must thank God. Who are they? Those who go down upon the sea, those who go through the wilderness, one who was ill and was cured, and one who was imprisoned and got out. Goes down upon the sea. I mean, this is it's very difficult to translate these things because the expressions, the idioms that exist in Aramaic don't necessarily translate. What we're speaking about is somebody who takes a voyage over the sea. Okay? So, now, that doesn't necessarily mean the ocean. Sea is almost specific here because this is being discussed in the area in which a seafaring voyage meant crossing the Mediterranean, right? So it doesn't need to be, it doesn't mean that you're discovering, can possibly be going across the actual ocean, because there was no notion that there really was much on the other side of the ocean at the time that this was written, right? Talking about going across the Mediterranean, which for all intents and purposes is the other side of the world. Okay, it means going from Babylonia to Rome, or something like that. Okay, Greece, whatever. Okay, now, somebody who travels the sea, who traverses the sea, somebody who goes through the wilderness on traveling by foot or by animal, whatever, caravan, but going through the wilderness, one who was ill and was cured, and one who was imprisoned and got out. So there is a basic theme here, which seems to be those people who were in some sort of dangerous situation and then exit from that dangerous situation, they have a pronounced obligation to thank God. I was in a difficult, dangerous, trying situation. I got out unscathed, unharmed, or at least relatively unscathed. Seasickness, a bit of scurvy perhaps, but basically I'm okay. So now I need to thank God as a result of having gotten out of that scenario. Where do we come up with these four, though, specifically? They're actually tied into the 107th chapter of Tehillim. In the 107th Psalm, we find that David speaks about different people, different scenarios, different circumstances, that a person finds himself in danger, gets out of danger, and then should thank God. So here we just have excerpts. They're excerpted in the Gemara itself, in the actual passage in the Talmud, and then I've excerpted it even further. So this is an even more abbreviated version than the Talmud has, but essentially what we find is that we're skipping around that 107th chapter of Psalms. From where do we know, the second paragraph, that those who go down upon the sea are included? How do you know that somebody who traverses the Mediterranean, let's say, needs to recite this blessing? As it is written, those who go down upon the sea in ships, they see the work of God. Let them thank God for his kindness and his wonders to the children of man. That's a little taste. You can read through the rest on your own if you like. But essentially, what we do is that for each one of these four scenarios, we look back to the 107th Psalm, and we find that there is an allusion made. And the way that I just stated it is backwards. Right? Clearly what happened is that Rav, who is the ultimate source of this idea, Rabbi Yehuda quotes this in the name of Rav, Rav saw this 107th Psalm, and he says that is the source text for the notion of the Gomel blessing. When we recite Birkas HaGomel, it should be done based upon the scenarios that are discussed in this Psalm. Okay. Based upon this passage of the Gemara, can we think of any other scenarios in which one might recite the Birkas HaGomel? Anything else? We've discussed only four scenarios. Going across the sea, being imprisoned, then getting airplane, train. They weren't going to discuss either of those, but okay. Right, exactly. So as things develop, we might find parallel circumstances that couldn't possibly have been discussed here, because those scenarios didn't exist yet, but clearly parallel what we find in the Talmud. What else? Any other scenarios? Surviving a war, I was on the front lines, I had bullets whizzing past my head, and then I get out unscathed. That's not discussed, right?
Earthquakes, tornadoes.
Earthquakes, natural disasters aren't discussed. You survive a tornado, okay? You survive
almost
an earthquake.
Any situation could be a potential dangerous situation. Almost anything you think of could become.
What do you mean?
Dangerous.
Like,
almost.
Like you leave your house in the morning, you never know. Okay. Okay. So then we may need to... So we may need to narrow it further, or we may say that yeah, okay. I mean, if you can potentially turn any scenario into a dangerous, life-threatening situation, you know, I once heard somebody say, I don't know where this quote is from originally, but if you wash your pants, right, you should have to make a Birkas HaGomel. Why? Because if you were still inside of them when they were being washed, you'd die, right? So... You'd get dizzy for sure. You might drown, you know. So we're going to have to generally... I want to hold off on the real halachic, the practical halacha for a minute. But we might understand that it would have to be a significant near miss, right? Meaning we can't necessarily say that just because I crossed the street that, well, if there was a car that was coming at that exact moment, so I would have been a goner. That's true, but maybe there needs to be something that hits a little bit closer to home for us to... to then be compelled
like
to thank God. Like the car almost hits you, or that might not even be enough. Maybe the car actually has to hit you and you survive. Right? Now, I wouldn't suggest that you try to put yourself in a scenario, I love God so much, I want to thank him. Let me, you know, jump out of this helicopter, and then I'll have an opportunity. Danny and then Marvin.
Well, these four categories, except for one, seem similar to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're doing this on your own volition, almost. You may have chosen to go on an ocean voyage or on an airplane.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about a train. You chose to go into the wilderness.
Right.
You didn't choose to get sick, but maybe you put yourself somewhere where you got sick.
Maybe.
And then being in prison, you know, you could have been captured, but you may have done something. You put yourself in harm's way.
So
as opposed to... A tornado, an example, that someone threw out a natural disaster.
Right.
That's not something you had any control over.
Right.
And so I don't know.
Yeah, even just as you were speaking, I mean, I didn't really think of it in those terms. Even just as you were describing them, it almost sounds like there may be a divide between, you know, two and two. That what we would really say is clearly of, you know, no one, let's assume no one put a gun to your head or a sword to your nape and said, get on the boat. Let's assume that you are, even if it's for some sort of real need, right, that you're trying to escape some horrible land, or you need to go on a ocean voyage for the sake of earning a livelihood, or crossing the wilderness. In both those instances, it's really of your own volition. Whereas I could imagine that, you know, somebody who, even if they weren't necessarily the most responsible in terms of buttoning up before you go outside, somebody who gets sick, and also somebody who's captured and then imprisoned.
And a humankind intervention versus something that would be from God, like a tornado or something.
Right, right.
I would wonder, would you say go, Mel, if you were struck by lightning?
And survive.
Let's hold off.
Okay.
Maybe. I don't want to say one way or the other yet. Okay. Right? But it's a good question. It's a fair question. Marvin and then Elise, you had a question? Yeah.
The only thing I was thinking, you would definitely say go, Mel, if you were in a house that's hit by a tornado and you survived that. But in addition, I would think that when you're talking about crossing the desert, where you're subject to many of these things, that would include being a tornado or a storm of some sort that came up, where you'd be exposed to danger.
Okay. Excellent point. That part of perhaps the reason why we're saying crossing the wilderness necessitates saying go mill afterwards is because of the presumption that some of those dangers will come up. You'll be exposed to some of those dangers that we've just mentioned on the path of the wilderness or seafaring voyage, right? That what to us is not a hurricane because it never hits land, but if you're caught up in a storm at sea, it's the same deal. It's the same thing. So there may be this presumed danger that is always implicit in any sort of ocean voyage. And if you make it to the other side, you'd be okay. And then does that assume that if one of those things were to, let's say, hit land, that would also necessitate bench and gomel? But at least for now, I want to shy away from saying that, yes, this would or this wouldn't require bench and gomel. I think that what we want to pull away from this passage, at least right now, and again, the important thing is that we sort of clear our minds of everything that we know about halacha. Because what we know about halacha comes to us from the prism of many, many generations through which this Gemara ultimately passes. What we're trying to do whenever we study Gemara is we're trying to put ourselves back prior to that prism of all those generations ever takes place. That lens doesn't exist yet. We are sitting around the table with the sages of the Talmud, and that's what we're trying to figure out. That's what we're discussing. So I pull away from, or let's say, in the first generation following the Talmud. Okay, so there is no Maimonides yet, and there is no Shulchan Aruch, and there is no Rush and Rif and Ramah or any of these other greats that we're now familiar with today who give us what halacha is in the contemporary here and now. We are fast forwarding. So if I come, if I am the first generation who ever had the Talmud and I'm opening it up and I come across this passage, I say that there are really two ways of interpreting this or of understanding this. Number one is that there are only four instances, only four people, only four scenarios which would require the recitation of Birkas HaGomel, on the one hand. On the other hand, what I might say is, no, these are examples that are given. David is in this psalm upon which the whole notion of these four individuals is based. David is just thanking God for all kinds of scenarios that were commonplace, all kinds of scenarios or four specific scenarios in which we can imagine that your life is in danger and then you survive, so you would have to give thanks to God. But it's a paradigm. It's a paradigm for being in danger and then surviving. So if I'm in another scenario, if a tornado strikes somebody's house and he survives that, so then of course you recite Birkas HaGomel. Those are two different perspectives that I might have reeling from this Gemara. Elise.
I kind of touched on what I was going to ask because this is a, for example, when we tried to do the put ourselves in situations where we can make brachas, not endangering our life. For example, when we say wine before we do hamotzi, when we're doing, so that we can say the bracha for wine and, rather than having it covered by the bread, so we do it first. So you can say an extra bracha. Is it considered better to use a broader interpretation, like you're saying, and just anytime you survive anything that's life-threatening, for example, the tornado siren went off, but no tornado hit, but he was still left
right.
Not having been hit by a tornado, or you actually have to have the tornado hit and survive the actual devastation. Is it better to give a broader interpretation?
So practically, we'll get into what kinds of scenarios perhaps would require the blessing, but I think in a more broad context, you're raising an important point, which is, essentially, so what's the terrible if we make more blessings, right? So what's the problem? Why not interpret this passage? Why doesn't everybody interpret this passage? We haven't yet seen how it's been interpreted, but why not interpret it as liberally as possible to provide the most opportunities for the recitation of the blessing? How wonderful. So there are two issues with that. Issue number one is more almost emotional or psychological, really, that the more often something is done, the less drama and the less potency it can possibly maintain. Hanukkah is special because it comes but once a year. If we had Hanukkah once a month, right? This is the difficulty of Shabbos. Shabbos often doesn't get its due, right? We don't make as big a deal of Shabbos as we do the holidays because Shabbos comes once a week. Provides a very important oasis on the one hand, but on the other hand, it doesn't. It somehow doesn't conjure up all those childhood memories necessarily the same way that Pesach does, right? When I cannot smell chicken soup without having a smile across my face and thinking of like Pesach, right? In my house, there are certain things. Or I was eating a granola bar the other day, and it was this like walnut cinnamon situation, and I'm eating this thing. And somehow, like, these endorphins are being released in my head because I'm thinking of Pesach as a kid as soon as I eat walnuts and cinnamon. It's an amazing thing. So if Pesach were to come multiple times a year, if we were to have that every, you know, season, it would be much more difficult to maintain that sort of magic and grandeur and all of that. So that's number one. Number two is that in a purely halachic context, the issue is that we are up against a prohibition of reciting God's name in vain. And that's always the challenge that we have when it comes to blessings, when it comes to prayers, etc., is that when we are obligated, we take it very seriously, and we do, but we are sort of walking a fine line between reciting the blessings that we need to and that we should versus saying them out of context and potentially being in violation of taking God's name in vain. So when it comes to blessings specifically, that's one of the issues that we find ourselves in. So it does become important to look back to this original source and understand it properly and figure out how we're going to manage it.
When David wrote this psalm, he saw all these things in life and death situations.
Right.
He said it was a
doesn't like a common cold.
Fair.
Today, we get a common cold and you're over it and away from the deal.
Okay, right.
But everything when you got sick was a life and death situation.
Okay.
Because people can survive.
Perhaps, perhaps. Right. So which would certainly, if we're going to, so again, if we view this passage of the Talmud in a very narrow context, an extremely narrow context, we might say that whatever was listed here becomes what we recite this blessing for, no more, no less. But it could be that if we expand it to say that essentially what we're driving at is a basic theme, when you're in a life-threatening situation, that is going to depend on, you know, the times and the era in which you live. Exactly. Questions? Keep going. Okay. Page 2. Yeah.
Back to the broader context or the narrow one. For example, when you say the traveler's prayer.
Right.
There are very specific instructions. If you go this far outside the gates of the city and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Were there not any more decisive instructions?
So when it comes to the traveler's
prayer. Or is it just open to interpretation?
So again, much of what we know, let's say, about the traveler's prayer, etc., comes to us from interpretations of the Talmud, which was more vague than it comes across to us in more contemporary writings, right? So I don't remember. I don't remember offhand.
How many outside the gate? I mean, it's a much more
the notion of the traveler. This is all we have when it comes to Birkat HaGomel. Yeah, this is all we have when it comes to the traveler's prayer. It's also very different, sort of. Well, you'll see as we continue, we'll actually find a distinction specifically between the two, and why we might find them different from one another. Okay, so we're in terms of the flow of the generations that we've been speaking about, we're going a little bit out of order. I want to jump right into the Shulchan Aruch now. Shulchan Aruch is much more contemporary than all of those medieval scholars and Talmudic commentators that we find in between, like the Rambam, right? Rambam, Rashi, etc. We're all before the Shulchan Aruch, but the Shulchan Aruch sort of becomes an important touchstone for contemporary halacha, okay? So let's take a look. Here is the Shulchan Aruch in the broader context. This is the area of the Shulchan Aruch in which blessings in general are discussed. And here he begins to discuss the notion of Gomel. So he quotes the Gemara, first of all. And he says, this is in paragraph 1, Sif Aleph. Four individuals must give thanks. Those who go down to the sea when they rise up from it. Those who go through the wilderness when they arrive at a civilized area. One who was sick and was cured. And one who was imprisoned and went free. The exact same four that are discussed in the Gemara. Now, the reason why this is important is because, well, every word of the Shulchan Aruch is more, and it's true of the Rambam also, it's more calculated, perhaps, than the Talmud. I mean, the Talmud may be very vague by design, right? Well, the Talmud wasn't necessarily meant to be, it wasn't meant to be, a guide to practical law. You can get that sense just from reading through one page, and you see how it's this stream of conscience almost, and discussions, and we go off topic, and tangential points, etc. It was meant to be a code of, or a corpus of law, thought, ideas, etc., but not always totally practical and zeroing in on every specific scenario. When the Shulchan Aruch writes, it is. Okay, so he begins with that. He begins with this passage of the Talmud, but then he continues, and we're skipping. Now we go down to paragraph 9 here. It is not limited to these four specifically, for the same law applies to anyone for whom a miracle occurred. What do we mean by a miracle? For example, if a wall fell upon him, or he was saved from being trampled and gored by an ox, or a lion came upon him in the city to maul him. He says in the city specifically. Meaning, true, if you're traveling through the wilderness, you might expect to be mauled by lions and tigers and bears, oh my. But if you're in the city, then I would never suggest that you just wake up in the morning and you step outside your house, that you should recite a Birkat HaGomel. But if you open the door to your house and there's, the mailman is lying on the floor and there's a lion on top of him, so then I might recite a Birkat HaGomel. Or thieves who are bandits of the night came upon him and he was saved from them. Or any other such case, they all must recite the HaGomel blessing. Why? Because going back to that passage of the Talmud, what we would be saying in this perspective is that we're interpreting it in a more liberal, more broad sort of context. It's not only these four. It's a paradigm for anyone who has survived something that is potentially life-threatening. There's no magic to crossing the wilderness. The reason why we say if you cross the wilderness, you need to recite the Gomel blessing when you come out is because you're likely to be mauled by a lion or to have an altercation with some bandits along the way, highway robbers, whatever. So if you survive that, recite the Birkat HaGomel. What if I come across these highway bandits when I, you know, just head on to, I-75? Then you should also recite the Birkat HaGomel. What if there's a lion or tiger or bear, oh my, who is waiting for me at the footstep of my own home? Then you'd also recite a Birkat HaGomel. It doesn't need to be one who crosses the wilderness. But, here we go, and others say. He says, Yesh Omrim. Others say that HaGomel is not recited except by these four specifically. And it is best to recite the blessing without mentioning God's name or kingship, what we call Shem U'Malchus. That is the what makes the blessing. Okay, so a couple of things here. He offers these two perspectives, right? One is that we interpret it liberally. It's a paradigm. It applies to any life-threatening situation. And another is that, no, it's these four specifically that are actually mentioned in the Talmud and originally by David in Psalm 107. Now, whenever the Shulchan Aruch presents two perspectives, the general rule that we have in understanding the Shulchan Aruch is that the second is always what he believes to be the actual law, how he would advise the law to be followed. Whenever we have this is the law, and then V'yesh Omrim, and others say that it should be practiced as such, it's that, and others say, it's that second perspective that the Shulchan Aruch really works with. So he personally would say, would state, would declare, advise, whatever, that we not recite the Birkas HaGomel for all these scenarios, except that what he says is, so say it without God's name. So at least this goes back to your point. The issue that we always come up with when it comes to any blessing, well, why not? Well, what could we possibly, what are we losing out on by reciting an extra blessing here and there? One of the issues is that in taking God's name, if it's not really mandated and we're not obligated to do so, we might be taking his name in vain. So he says, in these sorts of situations where we do feel that a miracle has occurred and we do want to give thanks, I survived a life-threatening scenario, then we do want to give thanks, but do so without actually mentioning God's name per se.
How can you do that? How can you say without God's name?
You say, Baruch HaGomel HaChayivim Tovot Shagmalani Kol Tov, without saying God's name. Blessed is the one who bestowed kindness upon me, right, and saving me. But I do so without actually mentioning his name, right? I mean, you can address people without mentioning their name. This, my mother-in-law was very wise. As soon as Sarah and I got engaged, she said, listen, we want you to call us mom and dad. I said, you got it. Why is that so wise? Because there are people who just sort of say, pass the salt, you, until you have kids, and then you can call them grandma and grandpa or Bubby and Zadie or whatever, right? So you can absolutely refer to individuals, beings, people, whatever, God, without actually mentioning his name. He knows who we're talking about.
You
hey, you, thanks for...
You can bless Hashem without mentioning his name?
Well, think about the actual words. Rather than saying, blessed are you, God, I could say, blessed is the one who bestowed kindness upon me, right? Using a pronoun rather than his name, right? Any other hands up, questions? We're good? Okay. Fine. So we have these two different perspectives. Now, it gets interesting. Let's roll this back a little bit. Now let's turn back to the Rambam, okay? So whenever the Shulchan Aruch writes, he generally takes more than any others, there are three opinions that he takes into account. Okay, it's the Rambam, the Rif, and the Rush. Okay, Rambam is Maimonides. Rif is Rav Yitzchak Alfasi, right? Alfasi meaning from Fez, originally from Fez, Morocco, and then traveled back up to Spain. I believe he lived in Toledo at the end of his life, not Toledo, Toledo in Spain, at the end of his life, I believe. And I may be confusing him with the Rush now. Anyway, he was from Morocco. He was of Sephardic origin and lived a few generations before the Rambam. Very important halachic authority, as was the Rush, Rabbeinu Asher, who lived a couple centuries after the Rambam. Okay, so those are three really important halachic personalities that the Shulchan Aruch takes into account in determining his own version of the law. So the Rambam is going to be very important as far as the development and the flow of halacha down to the Shulchan Aruch. So what does the Rambam actually say? He says, four must give thanks. One who is ill, who is cured. One who is in prison, who is freed from prison. Those who go down upon the sea when they arise from it. And those who take journeys when they arrive back at civilization. You won't find any further commentary in the Rambam. Okay, that's not just a snippet. That is, I mean, it is a snippet. But at no later point does he flesh out, oh, or anything like these scenarios, tornadoes and hurricanes and lions and tigers and bears, oh my. Nothing like that. It's these four, because that's all we have mentioned both in the Gemara and then also in the Psalm 107 when David talks about it. Okay, now we come to a really interesting explanation. This is on page 3, okay? Shut Rivash. It's fun to say. Shut is it's an acronym. It stands for She'elot U'Tshuvot. It's responsa, right? Questions and answers. Okay, so these are responsa of the Rivash. The Rivash was another acronym, Rav Yitzchak ben Sheshes. Very important figure, especially because of his responsa, practical responsa that come out from the medieval period, which are very important. This is when this is a very important period as far as the determination and the explanation of the laws or ideas that we find in the Talmud. Okay, so much of practical law is going to hinge upon what was interpreted during this period. Here's what he says. It's a really interesting approach, and he takes clearly one approach over the other, but he gives an important explanation for it. Here's the question. The question is, that which is said in chapter Haroah, okay, this is the perek, the chapter of Brachot that we're dealing with. Okay, it's referring to our Gemara, the one that we're discussing. That four individuals must give thanks, relying upon the verses of the Psalm. Do we say that it is these specifically, for we rely upon the verses, meaning the verses only contain these four? This is exactly our point, exactly our question. Someone had the presence of mind to actually ask a great authority during the... Rivash was the 15th century, I believe. It's towards the end of the medieval period. Is it those verses specifically? Okay, do we say that it is these specifically for rely upon the verses? And if so, even if a wall fell upon him, or he was saved from the trampling and goring of an ox, or other such incidents, he would not be obligated to recite the blessing? Or do we say that all the more so, he is obligated? All the more so! Meaning, if you cross the wilderness, what's the fear? The fear is that a lion may trample you. So what if he actually got trampled by a lion, but it just happened like in his office? Right? You open the door to your office one day, you're sitting down to your cubicle, ah! Okay, and he survives! He survived, so why wouldn't you recite a Birkat HaGomel? All the more so, but he's not sure, because the fact is, the Gemara, see, the Talmud works with this psalm. So if we just leave it with the psalm, then I could understand that, you know, David was, you know, there's a certain poetry that gets worked into the psalms. The psalms is not a halachic work, right? Mm-hmm. But the Gemara sort of was, not exhaustive the same way that the Rambam was, or the same way that the Shulchan Aruch was, but the Talmud is much more of a halachic work. So the idea that the Talmud picks up on this psalm but then doesn't expound upon any of the scenarios might lead us to believe that it's only these four. We're not certain. So this is the question that is posed to Rav Yitzchak ben Sheshes, to the Rivash. Here's what he says. Really interesting logic here. It's a lot of fun. It seems that he would be required to recite the blessing. Okay. For those who go through the wilderness and must give thanks, do so because of the danger of a lion or robbers which are found upon the roads. And if so, when a lion arises to maul him, even in the city, it could happen at the front door to your house, it could happen when you go to Kroger and, you know, what aisle is the coffee? 13? Oh, great, and you turn down aisle 13 and there's coffee and tea and a lion! And he jumps on top of you and you kick him off and you throw him into the DVDs and they get a... I don't know, someone pops out from that little Fifth Third Bank section with a lion net, and they trap him, okay? Baruch Hashem, Gomel, okay? So it can happen anywhere. The reason why we say that crossing the wilderness requires the recitation of this blessing is because you might get mauled by a lion. But if you were actually mauled by a lion, so all the more so. Okay, do so because of the danger of a lion or robbers which are found upon the roads. And if so, when a lion arises to maul him, even in the city, or if robbers come upon him, and they are bandits of the night, meaning we keep on giving that qualification, because we're saying not like stam, regular robbers, robbers who, you know, come firing, come pack in heat, and he's saved from them, or any other such miracle, all the more so he would be required to give thanks. And these four are only mentioned in the scriptures because they are constantly present in the travels of most people. It's a paradigm. David is speaking about what we call Naisa B'chol Yom. It happens each and every day. He's speaking about the norm. People take ocean voyages, and people go across the wilderness, and things happen. People get sick, and then they get better. So he's speaking about scenarios that are, we all laughed when I spoke about the lion trampling somebody in Kroger, because it's never going to happen. David is speaking about the norm. But if you have an abnormal situation, certainly you'd make a bracha, you'd recite the blessing. And so did Rabbi Yehuda mention in the name of the Baal HaMa'or. Okay, so he quotes other, he's going to do this throughout, that he quotes other halakhic authorities to bolster his opinion. And all the more so regarding one for whom a miracle was performed and he was saved from death itself. For they established another blessing for him to recite when he passes by that place again. This is very important. Okay, here we need a little bit of background. There's another blessing. There's another blessing that you recite. There is the Tefillat HaDerech, the Traveler's Prayer, which Elise mentioned before. We're going to have to keep that in mind. But there's another blessing, which is that any time one comes to a spot at which a miracle was performed for him, survived a horrible train wreck, or survived any sort of scenario in which one's life was really threatened, when you pass by that place, there's a bracha that's recited, Sha'asa li neis b'makom hazeh, right, that God performed a miracle for me in this place. Every time you cross by that place, the passing by that place necessitates the recitation of a blessing. Yeah? Theoretically? Probably.
You might need to learn that
first. You might need to learn that blessing, yeah. Yeah. So, it's an unfortunate scenario, but survivors of a concentration camp. Okay, you go back to the concentration camp, if you can bring yourself to do so, there would be, I mean, all kinds of, you know, they're open for, I hate to use that term, tourists, but they're open for those seeking education. But Heritage, March of the Living, and all those sorts of things. But should a survivor go back to one of those places, this would be a blessing that would be recited. I want to be clear, it's not that you're blessing the place, right? It's not that God, please, you know, protect this area. It's that I recognize this as a place of incredible danger, perhaps just for me, perhaps for others as well, and I survived, and we give God thanks for having survived. Not for having created the scenario in the first place, but for having survived such a horrific scenario. Okay, now, that's a blessing that needs to be recited. We know that. So we know that that blessing, if in aisle 13 he was almost mauled by a lion, when he crosses by aisle 13, he is going to need to recite that blessing. Okay, that's for sure. Now, according to the text of the Gaonim, okay, so there are variant versions of the Gemara here, but the Gaonim was the period immediately following the period of the Talmud. We say, according to their text, he is obligated to recite the blessing as well as his son and grandson. It's not only the person himself, but a survivor's grandchildren. Perhaps even, still others explain, according to their version of the text, that it is not limited to his grandson, but all future descendants for all time. In 6 generations from now, if you know that your great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, grandmother survived Auschwitz, and you're there on a heritage trip or whatever, March of the Living, whatever it may be, you recite the blessing that God performed a miracle for my ancestor here in this place. And all the more so, that as soon as he was saved, that he would be obligated to give thanks, just as the four who need to give thanks, okay? Consider this. Yeah, and he actually fleshes this out in the final paragraph. And it is not the case that he would be exempt from the Thanksgiving blessing by reciting the blessing of who performed a miracle for me. Meaning, maybe you'd say, well, you don't make a Birkat HaGomel, but when you pass by this place, so that's when you make the blessing. Sha'asa li neis b'makom hazeh, that God performed a miracle for me here in this place. He says, for perhaps he will never again pass by that place, and so will never recite that blessing. He says, I just can't make sense of this. You're telling me that the next time I go to aisle 13, I need to recite a blessing because God performed a miracle for me there in that place. Okay, what if I'm so traumatized that I can't bring myself to ever go back to aisle 13 or any other Kroger, or I can't even look at a cup of coffee or a cup of tea ever again? Right, what if I just never go back to that place? So I'm never going to recite any blessing? You mean I never have to thank God for having saved me from a lion? That's ridiculous. If you tell me that there was never such a blessing that was ever established or ever decreed that you should thank God for a miracle. All right, so then this is just some sort of strange blessing. Birkat HaGomel has all these crazy, strange kinds of permutations to it that ends up being that you never thank God for a miracle. Okay, fine. But what we have on the books is a blessing that says I'm supposed to thank God when a miracle happens, but only if I pass by the place. So if I never pass by the place, then I'm not supposed to recite any kind of blessing. It just doesn't make any sense. If I pass by the place, you recite the blessing. What if it just never happens? I never pass by the place ever again, so I don't thank God for the miracle? Clearly, I'm supposed to thank God for a miracle. There's a blessing that's been established. So he surmises that the blessing that you recite for a miracle having occurred no matter where you are must be the Birkas HaGomel. Okay, it's a really interesting sort of thought process. I like it a lot. So even if he never goes back, and even if his children never go back or grandchildren never go back to aisle 13 or any other place of horror or doom that he was saved from, you have an obligation to thank God for your own survival.
When would you say that? During the daily prayer?
You say, so when do we practically say Birkas HaGomel? Part of it is that we need to have a minyan. We usually do it with, it works in tandem with an aliyah, usually. Practically speaking,
yeah,
that's what we do. Okay? So it's done in shul. Women also would say it in shul, right? That doesn't go in tandem with an aliyah, obviously, but still in the context in the presence of a minyan. Okay? Now, that is the opinion of the Rivash, okay? So we've seen a number of opinions here. We have the Shulchan Aruch who quotes both, clearly inclines towards the Rambam, which is that it's these four specifically. Working backwards, then we saw the Rivash a few centuries before, kind of in between the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch. The Rivash, Rav Yitzchak Ben Sheshes, says, no, it has to be any scenario. Has to be any circumstance, any situation. Now comes the Tur, okay? The Tur was the first, this was actually the son of the Rosh, his name was Rabbi Yaakov Ben Asher, and he authored what was sort of like almost a predecessor to the Shulchan Aruch. Very similar style. It's a similar compendium of halacha, similar halachic sort of encyclopedia. What happened was the Shulchan Aruch wrote a commentary on this, which is called the Beis Yosef, and that commentary was then distilled into the Shulchan Aruch's own version of the Shulchan Aruch, Rav Yosef Karo's own version, which he called the Shulchan Aruch. Okay, but this became a very important work. The Tur was an Ashkenazi. That's going to be important. So here's what the Tur says. And we are accustomed in Ashkenaz and France to not recite the blessing when we travel from city to city, for they did not obligate the recitation of the blessing except for those who travel through the wilderness, where wild animals and bandits are common. Pause there for a second. So Marsha, coming back to your point, right? It may very well have been that traveling, that when King David lived, traveling from Jerusalem to Hebron would have necessitated the blessing. But now, by the time the Tur comes around, and there are more paved roads, and it's not quite as frightening, it would only be, the notion is traveling through the wilderness, right? Traveling through the wilderness. So you have to find the wilderness. It's getting more and more difficult to find the wilderness, especially today, right? Even highways that travel through areas that aren't, you know, civilized per se, because there are no cities that dot the side of I-80, but nevertheless, it's not that same sort of scenario. Okay? So,
You just get out our GPS.
Yeah, exactly. You don't even have to stop for directions. Yeah, right. Exactly. Okay? So he says that we don't do it when we go from city to city, for they did not obligate the recitation of the blessing except for those who travel through the wilderness, where wild animals and bandits are common. And regarding that which is stated in the Jerusalem Talmud, all roads are presumed dangerous. It's a quote from the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud. He says, we don't really buy that. It's not that we don't buy that, but you have to understand the context in which it was stated. This was only stated regarding the traveler's prayer. So this is where it becomes important. We find that there's a distinction between the two. What is it? That for traveling upon any road, one must beseech mercy for himself. But the thanksgiving blessing was established in place of the thanksgiving offering. Now we come to it, okay? When do you bring a thanksgiving offering in the temple? When would that have been done? When you survived a life-threatening scenario, when a miracle occurred. when do we recite the traveler's prayer, Tefillas HaDerech? If I go up to Detroit, I say Tefillas HaDerech, because I am supposed to ask God to watch over me and protect me the same way that I recite Shemona Esrei in the morning. Nothing's gone wrong yet, right? And hopefully nothing will. And I recite Shemona Esrei at Mincha and again at Maariv. Nothing's gone wrong, but you're supposed to constantly ask God for mercy, to watch over us, protect us, ask for our needs. God, get me to the destination safely and soundly. Okay, but that doesn't mean that I've survived any sort of life-threatening scenario. That's what the Jerusalem Talmud is talking about. All roads are presumed dangerous as far as Tfilas HaDerech goes. So if it's enough of a distance from one city to the next, then I would be required to recite it. Similarly, regarding one who is ill, Rabbi Yosef wrote that this is specifically one who fell into bed, one who survived something that at least was potentially threatening. But one who had a headache or a stomach ache needs not recite the blessing. I go to sleep early because of a headache. You wake up in the morning, you feel fine. You don't recite the Birkas HaGomel. And so wrote the Ravid, that it is specifically for one who suffered a potentially fatal blow, either malady, illness, or some sort of actual attack, whatever, and is then in danger. But the Rambam wrote that for every road and every malady, one must give thanks. For we read in the Jerusalem Talmud, all roads are presumed dangerous, and he takes that to mean, right, and all those who are ill are presumed to be in danger, he takes that to mean every scenario, every road, every illness, you have a headache, you have a stomachache, you get up in the morning, you say Birkas HaGomel. And so it is written in the Aruch that even one who has a pain in his eyes or head must recite the blessing, and so are they accustomed in Sfarad. What we find is that those two perspectives of the Gemara that we originally started off with find their way down through the whole chain of transmission and the lens of all these different generations throughout history, practically speaking, into the Ashkenazic and Sephardic community. The Ashkenazic understand the passage of the Talmud in a much more broad and liberal context. It's a paradigm for every life-threatening situation in which I can say, God essentially performed a miracle for me, mini-miracle. And the Sephardim say that, no, you don't need the mini-miracle. You thank God even when there's been some sort of potential pain, threat, whatever, that's when I recite the blessing. So that's what we find in the Shulchan Aruch, okay? In the Shulchan Aruch, we skipped a couple of paragraphs in between. Here's what we find. He quotes both of these opinions. And he says, in Ashkenaz in France, they don't recite the blessing when they travel from city to city, and etc., etc. Essentially, in Ashkenaz in France, they save this blessing for miraculous kinds of scenarios. And when it comes to the Sfardim will recite it even when it comes to more minor kinds of trips. And then the next paragraph, we're actually out of order here. It's a typo. It's supposed to be paragraph 8. But when it comes to sickness, the same deal. The Ashkenazim will recite it only for something serious, hospitalization. So you go to the hospital, even if really it was okay, it wasn't such a big deal, but still, hospitalization, once you go in, you know, it's considered at least mildly miraculous that you get out, so you still recite the blessing. And that would be for Ashkenazim. That's what the Ramah chimes in there at the bottom. But when it comes to the Sfardim have a much lower bar set as far as when we recite this blessing. Headache, stomach ache. If you need to lie down in bed as a result of whatever pain you're experiencing, when you get out of bed, you recite that blessing. Now, it's much easier, not just because I think we're all Ashkenazim in the room, but logically, it's much easier to embrace the Ashkenazic sort of approach. Because, a couple of things. First of all, it means that it's not quite as limiting, right? The passage of the Talmud and the Psalm is not limited exclusively to those four examples, but really it's just a paradigm, any miraculous kind of situation. But there's a more important point here, which is, you know, it's one thing to say that we set the bar lower, but once that bar has been achieved, then I recite the blessing. But essentially what we're saying in the Shulchan Aruch and the Rambam, if you follow the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch carefully, what we're saying is that if you were out in the wilderness and you survived, you recite the blessing. If you were mauled by a lion in aisle 13 and you survived, you don't recite the blessing. How do you make sense of that? How is it that if you survived a potentially life-threatening scenario, I do recite this Thanksgiving blessing. And yet, if I recite, if an actual life-threatening scenario happened that didn't quite make it into the Psalms, right, and wasn't discussed by David and wasn't discussed by the Gemara, so then I don't recite this blessing, I don't give thanks. How can that be? We're stymied by the same issue that the Rivash had. How can it be that you can go your whole life without ever thanking God for this miracle? What if I never pass by this place? So there's a really interesting suggestion. These sources I compiled basically piggybacking on a really interesting article that was written in a Torah journal called Shmatin. It's an Israeli Torah journal. And an article by Nerian Naveh. I don't know who he is. But really interesting article. And he makes a really interesting suggestion at the end. The very end. And it goes to this verse in the 107th chapter of Psalms. Okay? Remember, the 107th chapter is what this whole thing is based on. King David describes all of these different scenarios in which our lives might be in danger or whatever happens, and you come out, you're supposed to thank God. Thank God for his kindness. It's a refrain throughout the psalm again and again and again for these four scenarios. Here's what he says at the end. This is the final verse, I believe. Mi chacham v'yishmar eile v'yizbonenu chasdei Hashem. Whoever is wise, let him observe these things, and they shall meditate upon the kindnesses of God. So his suggestion is that it's interesting that King David sort of, he ties the whole thing off with this notion of v'yitbonenu, contemplate the kindnesses of God. Perhaps, that there is something unique and there's something special and there's something that David is really driving at here with this psalm, and that the Talmud then picks up on, which is that there's something about praising God for his kindness when the kindness is not so overt, when it's not so clear, it's not so in your face. It's not that you survived something that was so horrible and so terrible that your life was genuinely in danger. That almost goes without saying. But perhaps there is a blessing that was established. There's a notion of thanking God that was established for those kinds of things that aren't as overt. And it's an important exercise. That when things just seem to be going in a happenstance sort of way. And again, you got to be careful because it's not that you just wake up in the morning, but that when something is mildly dangerous, that we need to reflect upon the fact that my life was in danger. I'm really in God's hands. So much as just taking a journey. So much as just taking a trip. So much as just crossing over the sea. We do it all the time. But to recognize that when I do those things, I'm really in God's hands. So much could go wrong. When something really does go wrong, it's obvious. If you're stuck in your house and a tornado blows by and the whole house is swept up and you survive, so then it's clear that you have a debt owed to God. Not necessarily so when you simply take an ocean voyage, when you go on a cruise, when you fly over the ocean. Not necessarily so when you traverse a wilderness. Not necessarily so when you're just sick, right? It's a little infection, I'll be fine. You'll be fine if God takes care of you. But if that infection spreads and if things go wrong, then you won't be fine. That maybe there is a specific blessing that was established to open our eyes to those kinds of things. And that it isn't necessarily as, it's not that it's not as important, but it's not as necessary when it comes to things that are so overt that we're naturally inclined to, like, make a kiddush over it, right? That we're naturally inclined to have a more meaningful and deep and powerful Shemona Esrei as a result of that kind of experience. So that may be the divide here. It's a really interesting suggestion between the Ashkenazic and the Sephardic community. We get the Ashkenazic approach to this. Ashkenazic approach is, how can it be that you tell me to give thanks over potential danger but not over actual danger? Rather, it must be that if things actually take place, right, if a life-threatening scenario actually does arise, certainly I need to thank God. But the Sephardic approach is not without its reasoning, that it may very well be that a blessing was established just to be able to contemplate, v'yitbonenu chasdei Hashem, to contemplate the thanks or the kindnesses of God. It's supposed to be a wake-up call in a way that we don't necessarily think of otherwise. So as we gather around our tables right on Thursday and we're thinking about all those kinds of things, again, we have practical law, and then the beauty of these kinds of classes and Torah, etc., is that we can expand our minds a little bit in terms of the philosophical background for some of these things. We make Birkat HaGomel when we make Birkat HaGomel, but the very notion that perhaps there is a blessing there, and this seems to be maybe embraced by figures as great as the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch, that perhaps the blessing was established just as an eye-opener, just so that when you're in a scenario that's not, it's not like you're gonna lose sleep over it, it's not like you're so concerned, be a little more concerned. Recognize that you're really in God's hands and that hopefully He'll protect you and provide salvation, even though you might not necessarily think it's necessary. It's something to think about if we haven't had those life-threatening scenarios necessarily over the course of the past year. Certainly something to remember that even in the more pedestrian kinds of dangers, we're still in God's hands and He still protects us. Yeah, Mark.
The Thanksgiving prayers are Mogim, right?
In Shmona Esrei. Okay. That's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about here is Birkas HaGomel.
Okay, Mogim is it. So if something happened to me last night and I'm still alive to say prayers today and I say Mogim, isn't that kind of all-inclusive for the Birkas HaGomel?
Maybe, and it could be that within the Sephardic community, that's what they were relying upon. Remember the question that the Rivash poses: how could it be that you never thank God for the miracle? Well, the answer is perhaps. I don't really know how they would necessarily respond, but perhaps you do thank God for the miracle. You thank Him three times a day. You're given every opportunity in the world to thank God, and the Rivash clearly doesn't buy that. He says if there's a special blessing for thanking God for a miracle, then you should have to thank God with a similar sort of blessing, a special blessing. But maybe that's part of it, that you have every opportunity in the world to thank God through Modim, and if you survived a train crash, then that ought to be on your mind when you daven Maariv that night. And if it's not, there's something wrong. But the purpose of this blessing is to open your eyes to the fact that even if the train didn't crash, you're in God's hands and He protected you. And there's a certain thanks that's owed as a result of that. Okay, have a good day, everybody. Thanks for joining us.